Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For many, the future use of the former Cooper Stadium site hinges on the results of two noise studies done to determine how the proposed racetrack would affect those who live and work in the areas surrounding the site. Lay interpretations of the two studies have been criticized. We invited the original consultants to the show. One took us up on the invitation. Eric Zwirling is president of the Noise Consultancy. He's also director of the Rutgers University Noise Technical Assistance Center. He was hired by ROAR Columbus, ROAR stands for Redevelop Our Area Responsibly, to perform a noise study in contrast to the report from developer Arshot Investment Corporation. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks. And let me just clarify that it was actually Green Lawn that had hired me for the second study.
Okay. Green Lawn Cemetery.
Yes, ma'am.
Also with us is Stephanie Coe. Stephanie is the president and a founding member of the Southwest Civic Association, which supports the Arshot development. She has also been a member and secretary of the Southwest Area Commission since 2008. Stephanie was good enough to join us after repeated attempts to invite the consultant for Arshot, but she is in no way, does she in no way share the status of our other guest, Eric Zwirling. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephanie, let's start with you and just talk about why you are on the show today. They offered you up. We offered many different times for the other consultant to join the show. We gave him first pick. We had three people were writers of the study. None of them could join us. Why did they offer you up as an alternative?
Well, I think first off, Harris, Miller, and Hanson was selected as one of the three options that a community group presented to the developer. Members of the community as well as local government officials participated in an RFP to determine mm-hmm. three firms that mm-hmm. we thought he should use. And ultimately, he will be present tomorrow. As I think you know, there's a hearing mm-hmm. at City Council, and he will be here to address City Council and to address the community personally. And I believe he was just unavailable, so I was willing to
participate. Well, we gave him first choice over almost the course of 2 weeks. I just want to make it really clear. So I'm wondering why you, though, because you're not an expert in acoustical measurements.
No, not at all. But I think, we've spent, as members of the Area Commission and the Civic Association, the last 3 years learning more about this project. And in particular, I chaired two community forums in the April and May of last year. In which Mr. Minge presented at one of them and Mr. Zwirling presented at the other. And I'm pretty familiar with the reports and ultimately the issues that I think will be discussed here today. So I don't claim to know anything about the science specifically behind this, but I think, that's the realistic position of most people who are involved in this process. Very few members of council or the community have any background in acoustical engineering or sound.
Yeah, which is why it's great to have both engineers from both studies on the show. But anyways, Eric Zwirling, you are an expert, and you criticize Harris, Miller, and Hanson, forevermore known on the show as HMMH, for its use of outcome-based modeling, in that it determined what sound level from the track would not violate Columbus's noise code instead of figuring the impact of a reasonable worst-case scenario. Why is it important that they use an outcome-based model?
Well, because studies, generally, if you're doing an impact analysis, first of all, let me state that there are two different types of analyses that can be done. One is a regulatory compliance analysis, where you're simply looking at whether or not a facility will comply with a given regulation. Another one is an impact analysis, where you look at what are the reasonable worst-case scenarios that may arise from the operations of that facility. And HMNH themselves understand that the worst-case scenario is one that should be looked at. They produced a document for the federal government, Transit Noise and Assessment, Noise and Vibration Assessment. And in that, they themselves state specifically that the worst-case scenario should be looked at. And they did not follow their own guidance in the preparation of the Cooper Sound Study.
Well, that doesn't seem to bother folks who are supportive of people like Stephanie. Stephanie, that doesn't trouble you at all that they were just looking at the bottom or the base and not looking at what the ultimate impact could be?
Well, I understand what he's describing, and throughout this process we learned about the different types of studies, and they were hired to determine whether or not a facility could be built that would be within compliance of Columbus's noise ordinance, and that's the path they took to explore those issues. And I think a couple of highlights along with that are that there is a noise ordinance in the city of Columbus, and it has specific guidelines, and they have a right to operate a facility within those guidelines. The question from the beginning of this was, could that even be done?
Are you confident that the noise ordinance is will be enforced in Columbus and that they have the resources to enforce it?
We've talked about this in the past.
Right.
I understand that the noise ordinance has two parts specifically. One of them deals with decibel levels specifically, and the other part is more of a general nuisance kind of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a secret that there isn't ongoing enforcement of the decibel level portion of that noise ordinance because of equipment and personnel,
right,
et cetera, which is why the community wanted to find additional methods of addressing those kinds of concerns. And we went about executing a good neighbor agreement. And as I understand it, ultimately, when there's a BZA permit, special permit, that those kinds of monitoring and criteria and enforcement will be contained within that permit, or hopefully will be contained within that permit.
Eric Zwirling, you said that although HMMH's effort to their remediation plan, you said it was aggressive, the double wall system, but you said that that double wall system that they suggested has not been built before, and therefore it is unproven and untested. And that HMMH acknowledged these facts in a presentation to the Southwest Area Commission. But really, every situation is different. Every situation, almost every situation, every racetrack is different. How are you going to find a template that's been proven and tested in every case?
Well, at the very least, some large wall systems should be tested to determine whether or not they would be effective in remediating sound from a very large area source such as this. This is not a simple point source where the sound is originating at one single point, but rather this area source will be the entire track. And whether or not these walls will be effective in stopping the sound from this is just simply untested. And I think I'd like to just go back and address something that Ms. Koh pointed out, which is the regulatory compliance aspect of this. Even if everything that they say is accurate, which I will discuss given the opportunity why I don't believe it is, that the Columbus ordinance is simply not protective. And the standard that is applied here, which is a 65 decibel, 1 hour average, is one that HMNH themselves, in previous studies, they have stated that the impact level is 60 decibels. At 60 decibels, that is the level which will impact upon speech. And so what they have done here is, and throughout this study, is they have applied one set of standards in both the analysis of the noise, and then the impacts from that noise, different than other published data, that other published reports they put forth. Why is 60 decibels the limit, the unacceptable limit in other studies, whereas in Columbus they accept 65 decibels as the limit?
I want to address a couple of things with respect to that. You know, there are different facilities. I mean, you sort of have two issues here. Has this ever been built in the manner described? No. But sound absorption materials and barriers and systems are used every day, whether it's around airports or highways, both of which are also large sources of noise in a large area. And so, you know, this type of material and the design criteria are something that's been tested, just not in the context of a track that's fully encompassed by this type of sound absorption system. And secondly, I think the location of where this is and the current ambient noise it kind of gets forgotten in these discussions, because there are tracks that have had a lot of impact on communities, and most of us are familiar with those from doing a lot of research, and they have been predominantly in areas that were relatively quiet or very quiet prior to their existence, and they had a substantial impact on the surrounding community. Where this facility is going to be located is in the heart of, you know, major highways. The ambient noise today is probably in excess of 65 decibels at many points throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about a completely different environment with respect to impact, which is why the commissioners and the members of the Southwest Area Commission were ultimately supportive of this, because we had to look at this from the holistic picture of what we believe is best for the community as a whole.
Eric Zwirling, something that's irritated you a lot is the assertion by folks like Stephanie and others that you have said that if the levels in the model that HMMH produced are correct, that the levels output from the model are correct. In other words, you're saying that the study's fine.
I disagree with that statement. Mm-hmm. Let me explain first of all what an acoustical model is. An acoustical model is simply a three-dimensional representation of an environment, a digital terrain model, in which you place a source and then propagate it out from that source. So what I stated was that the model, the physical model of Columbus, the buildings, the location of the buildings, the topography, the intervening topography, those were all correct. But once you have that down, then everything else depends upon the assumptions and the inputs to that. I disagree with the assumptions, and also two other important points. When I looked at the study initially, I did not look into whether or not the track was banked or not. I've gone back and looked at their model. The track is a flat. In their model, it is a flat track. If the track is banked and it brings the elevation of the track up, then the effective height of the wall is reduced. And for every foot that the track is elevated on the banks, the efficacy of the walls themselves are reduced.
So are you saying there's going to be a flat track or a bank track?
No. I assume, the assumption, of course, is that it's a bank track. It has to be. I'm not a racing expert, but I've seen enough races that I know that it has to be banked. In their acoustical model, though, it is modeled as a flat track, which I believe is erroneous, and they have had 6 months to respond to my January report and have not refuted that assumption, that assertion on my part.
Stephanie Koh, what about the flat track versus banked track?
I'm not sure of the answer to that, so I'm not going to take a guess.
Okay.
I think...
Eric, go ahead.
The second point is that nowhere in their acoustical model did they discuss a PA system. There's going to be a PA system used both for races and, of course, if they have entertainment events such as concerts. The assumption is that the speakers will be elevated at some level above the track. All their emissions levels were modeled at track height. If you have speakers that are up 5, 10, 30, 40, 50 feet, then the efficacy of those walls will obviously be dramatically reduced because the source is now much higher.
But if you're familiar with the facility and what it's been used for many, many, many years, decades for that matter, there has been an existing PA system there that has been in operation. There have been concerts there. So when you talk about the impact on the community, you have to look at where we are today and what the community is accustomed to. And we have had a facility there that has had concerts, has had a PA system, has had events like that taking place. And so the question was about whether a racetrack could be there and what that would do within the confines of the city code.
So, right, Eric Zorling, the community standard already includes the PA system, the public address system, and concert and using it as a concert venue. Why is that a problem?
First of all, at a baseball game, the PA system must only be audible above the game and the crowd. In the case of a racetrack, the PA system must be audible above the racing, and that means several orders of magnitude more amplification on the sound system. And second of all, it's my understanding that track, that facility now, has been dormant for some time. I don't know the exact history of it, but these will once again be, though it is a similar source, a PA system. It's after that site has been dormant for some time, and people have started to habituate to the new condition at that site.
We have a lot more to talk about. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Eric Zorling, president of the Noyons Consultancy, and also Stephanie Koh, president of Southwest Civic Association. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook, coming up on the next On Point with Money Short, new calls to bring the U.S. military home from all over. We'll ask, could it be done and what would it mean? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
and On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 71 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies, showers and thunderstorms are likely to pop up this afternoon, a high right around 80 degrees. More showers and thunderstorms tonight, a low of 68. There's a chance of rain for Tuesday, along with some sunshine and a warmer day tomorrow, a high of 91 degrees. A chance of rain Tuesday night and a low of 71. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Tomorrow night, City Council considers a proposal to for a plan to redevelop the old Cooper Stadium site to a racetrack. And joining us now is Eric Zwirling. He's president of the Noise Consultancy. He's also director of the Rutgers University Noise Technical Assistance Center. He was hired by Greenlawn Cemetery to perform a noise study, in contrast to the report from developer Arshot Investment Corporation. The name of that consultant is Harris Miller Miller and Hansen, and we did invite them, gave them first choice on multiple times to be on the show, and they couldn't make it. So joining us instead is Stephanie Koh. She's president of the Southwest Civic Association. And thanks again, Stephanie, for stepping in.
Thank you.
There's two issues I want to get at. We don't have a lot of time. But, Eric, HMM measurements of ambient sound levels during weekdays and rush hour is an issue. You say that they do not represent the times when racing will occur, nights and weekends, and are misrepresented when the data is reported for a quote-unquote typical loud hour. So during nights and weekend, are the ambient levels expected to be higher than the sound of rush hour traffic?
Well, obviously, you don't need anybody from a university or from any other consulting firm to tell you that the ambient sound levels on the weekends and at nights, which is when many of these races will occur, will be lower than they are during a weekday during rush hour. And the issue with that, then, is that the they had stated in their presentation, HM&H, that there was going to be no significant impact. And they said that that was based on the fact that it was that the levels were going to be, what did they say specifically, sound levels will be below the ambient, quote, and then, quote, projected race noise levels are not higher than existing background levels. And that's just not accurate for the times that there will be racing. Further, not only did they take measurements at times that were not appropriate for comparative purposes, they also took measurements at locations that were not appropriate. In their own document for the federal government, they stated that the measurements should be taken at a location that is shielded from the lowest ambient. Let me see. Desired is a microphone location that is shielded somewhat from the ambient source. It should be taken so that noise impact will be assessed most critically. For Greenlawn, for instance, specifically, they took it at the north fence line, which is the closest to the highways, rather than in the interior where there are the active burial sites. So the locations and the times at which they took their ambience were incorrect, and their conclusions drawn from that data, that the levels will be below the ambient and thus have no impact, are simply not supported.
Stephanie Koh,
mm-hmm.
Are you troubled at all by where the data was reported from, or the data that was used, and when it was accumulated?
No, we've read both his reports and the reports prepared by HMMH. And I think the point at the end of all of this is that they have made a commitment to make sure that the decibel levels are less than 65.
Who's made a commitment?
The developer. I'm sorry. The developer has made a commitment that the facility will operate within the guidelines of the city ordinance that is 65 decibels or less. And that, so regardless of what criteria or measurements were used, he's made a commitment to operate within the 65 decibels, and then that's the key. At the end of the day, what the facility produces and the impact on the community is what we're focused on. And I'd like to go back to for a second to, you know, what Mr. Zwirling said about people getting accustomed to the facility.
Right, it hasn't been operating for, well, this is going into the second season now, right?
Right, but that's kind of the point, that we need that facility to be operational. It's having a negative impact on our community as we sit here. And when you talk about impact, you have to talk about more than just noise. And it's critical.
What we're talking about today is noise. So right. Let's stick to the point, Stephanie. We know that there's an economic element to this, and I really wanted to just stick to the noise consultancy issues and also, you know, the HMMH reports as much as we can within such a limited period of time. One issue with HMMH, it says that a significant portion of your report, Eric Zorling, discusses potential noise impacts from drag racing. They say, however, drag racing is not planned for Cooper Park. They say the noise modeling assumed the classes of race cars specified by the developer. So they say that they're basing their modeling on the race cars specified by the developer. And I'm not real, such as ARCA, late model stock cars, legends, midgets, and drift cars. The noise emissions from this class of vehicles are significantly lower than those in professional NASCAR and IndyCar races. Are you assuming a different class of race car, and why?
Well, let me state that there's two different studies that we're talking about. We prepared a study in 2009 mm-hmm. that was based upon artists' concept drawings that we saw, as well as news reports. And at that time, there was a drag strip that was considered.
Okay.
So there was a report that was prepared in August of 2009. HMNH then finally filed their report on what is the current configuration. The second report that I filed in January of this year was in response directly to the current report that HMNH filed. I want to address the issue about the 65 decibel standard here. One point that's important to understand is that the 65 decibels is a one-hour average. And in racetrack measurements that I have taken, racetracks are regularly, the maximum sound level is regularly 7 to 17 decibels above the average sound level. So when you have a 65 decibel average, you can have sound levels at the same location as high as 80 decibels. Now, HMNH in their own report, as I reported to discuss previously, the one for the Federal Transit Administration, they discuss how important it is to report the LMAX, the maximum sound level, when you're doing an impact assessment, when a noise source produces high intermittent noise levels, which may be objectionable. So to get a full picture of this, they should have, according to their own guidance, presented what would be the maximum levels, not just the average levels, and it would have put a very different complexion on this matter.
Stephanie Cole, what would be, they're saying, Eric said that they should be talking about what the maximum would be, not, the, in other words, the worst case scenario, not an averaging of the decibel levels.
Well, I think that the study, as I understand it, took into account worst case scenario conditions, and with respect to the race itself, the one-hour average is what is written into the code. Again, the question was, could the facility operate within the current law in the city of Columbus? And the developer has committed to doing that, and the study indicates that assuming the walls are built and the cars that operate are within the, have the suggested decibel levels to begin with, and the number of cars is monitored, that they can comply with the city code.
Now, I might be mixing up the studies again, Eric Zorling, and for that I apologize, but I did want to go back to what HMMH proposed, what they described as substantial noise abatement structures to contain the noise from race events, including a 35-foot-high sound-absorbing noise barrier surrounding the track and a second barrier along the south property line that ranges in height from 25 feet to 30 feet. And again, I might be confusing this. I thought you said that they only modeled the head height and that when their model is rerun to the second-story windows in Franklinton more than twice as high, the number of houses exposed above Columbus's noise limit increases significantly. Are we talking about the same thing here?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. What they're proposing to do is to put in substantial wall systems around the track. But the modeling that they did, the receptor height, where they model the specific sound levels is to the height of the head of a person standing on the sidewalk. Impact studies often will look at the second floor bedroom window, particularly in their testimony at the SWAC hearing. HMNH stated that the races will be till 10 o'clock at night, and they stated that the loudest races will often be the last races of the night. At 10 o'clock at night, there are going to be people who are attempting to sleep and at a second floor. And so and the levels at that second floor window are substantially higher than they are at ground level. And further, just talking about regulatory compliance, when a facility is looking for variances. When it's as large a facility as this, it's inappropriate to only just look at regulatory compliance. One must, if one is being responsible, look at impact beyond strict regulatory compliance. And that is why an impact analysis, not just strictly a regulatory compliance analysis with Columbus's flawed noise code, that must be included.
Stephanie Coe?
Well, I think when you talk about people potentially being asleep in second floor bedrooms, you also aren't taking into account the fact that there are walls and other barriers that, again, mitigate noise, which is why the code looks at the impact of the sound at a property line and at a normal standing height if someone was outside of the house. And I would assume Mr. Zerling would agree that the noise that you would hear inside a structure with walls and windows would be less than what you would hear outside of that
structure.
You know,
a lot of the complaints, for instance, and I know that this is not apples and apples, but a lot of the complaints that came from Polaris Amphitheater or came about Polaris Amphitheater came from people complaining that they couldn't sleep at night. Because most of the concerts, of course, and I assume most of the racing will take place during the summer when, except for this year, you sometimes have your windows open.
Yes, I'd like to address that. First of all, the 60-foot, let's just assuming for argument's sake that the model that they have, which is 65 decibels at these second floor windows, just for argument's sake, is correct. 65, and I disagree with that, but 65 decibels, EPA research has shown that with windows, the approximate national average with windows open, the attenuation of a building is 15 decibels. So it would be 65 outside would translate to 50 inside. The EPA has also shown that people start to wake up when noise from the outside starts to exceed 35 decibels. So, yes, it is somewhat lower when the sound goes from the outdoors to the indoors. But people sleep at 35. They don't sleep at 50. Those levels, 65 decibels from a racetrack outside, will wake people up inside.
But you're also not taking into consideration what exists today. The noise levels that we hear from the freeway, the highways, the train tracks are already higher than 35.
I'm saying indoors. The levels, HMNH's ambient sound level measurements were not taken at an appropriate time to be able to make the statement that at the time that this is occurring, at the locations that are relevant, not at the fence line, not next to the highway, but in the community where they're a couple of hundred feet away from the highways, that those are the levels at those distances.
We're going to take a couple calls now, one for and one against the racetrack. We'll take the first call from Mary in Franklinton. She opposes the racetrack. Her call came in first. Mary, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a question for Eric Zerling about the wind study in Tampa, Florida for racetracks and how it can actually be louder 1 and 2 miles away from a track versus close, based on inversion and wind.
Well, that's, you know, you summarized to a large extent the findings of the study. There was a paper that was recently published that discusses the impact of meteorology on the propagation of sound outdoors, and there are a number of factors that can render a wall system significantly ineffective. In excess of 1,000 feet, a couple hundred feet to 1,000 feet, wall systems are less and less effective because of the way that sound essentially bends over a barrier. In the case where you have various upwind propagation, where you have various meteorologic conditions, that can be tremendously exacerbated. So you can hear it at much higher levels at greater distances.
Thanks to Mary for that call. And now, John from Hilliard, you support the racetrack. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
The point I wanted to bring up is I belong to a sports car club that has held races on the parking lots at Cooper Stadium for several years. Mr. Zerling talks about the technical data and things not being accurate. He wants to see real-world testing. Well, in effect, by us racing back there for years, in my opinion, it does create a real-world testing situation. Many of the cars that we used were in excess of the noise volume that will be limited at Cooper Stadium, but yet we've never got one noise complaint. In fact, the huge majority of neighbors, even those closest to the track, never even knew we were there. and all of our events were on Saturdays, most of them on Sundays, during times when he says, you know, it's already quiet in the neighborhood. I'd like to hear a comment on that.
Eric Zwirling?
Well, I haven't seen those events. I'm not aware. This is the first information I've had on those events. Obviously, it depends upon the number of vehicles that are racing as to what the sound levels will be. For every doubling of the number of identical sound sources, it increases by 3 decibels. So if, depending upon the number, it could be a significantly higher level than just one or two cars. In addition, you know, complaints I often see, it's a function of who somebody calls. If they were to call, for instance, the Columbus Police Department, would the caller or his club be aware of that? Would the information be transferred to them? There's often a disconnect between when people say that there are no complaints and the mechanism for gathering that information and reporting it.
Stephanie Coe, are you familiar with those races that that John from Hilliard was talking about?
Yes, they've been taking place in the parking lots and at that facility.
Is it apples and apples or is it apples and oranges? Are we talking about the same kind of racing?
Yes, we're talking about the same kind of racing that will potentially take place at the facility when it's constructed.
Why hasn't this been brought up more often if they've never received any complaints?
It has been brought up repeatedly. It was discussed in our community forums and it's been discussed at most of the meetings that I've been to. And in a number of the documents back and forth that when we've talked about events that have taken place there in the past. So these types of races take place in the parking lots around OSU and in other places. And again, I think that's where some of the confusion and fear that has impacted this comes from having conversations about drag strips and NASCAR events. And as you read HMMH's study, what's proposed here are a lower level or a less noisy level of racing. Just as John described.
So they're already doing the stock car races out there?
I don't think you would call them stock car races. I'm not an expert on car racing, but I think there's some of the sport car racing. I'm trying to think of the right word.
But it's not. But what we're the racing that they're talking about doesn't necessarily include all the different kinds of racing that would occur if the RSHOT development goes through.
Right. We anticipate that there will be multiple types of racing, but this is one of the types of races and one of the, I guess, louder types of races that can go on. And there are multiple cars, and that's what has gone on in the parking lot of Cooper Park and has gone on in parking lots surrounding OSU and other places for years.
Stephanie Coe, president of the Southwest Civic Association, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eric Zwirling, you'll be in town again tomorrow night again, right?
No, I'm teaching a course, community noise enforcement certification course here in New Jersey, as I do all over the country.
Okay.
I will be unavailable.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Coming up, we're going to talk about the do's and don'ts of concealed carry in bars and restaurants that serve alcohol. Hopefully, everyone will show up for that interview, too. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Jim Shepherd tells us why his newest book is a collection of short stories.
I think I'm attracted in the short story form to the notion that I will make less money and reach fewer people.
Shepherd's book, You Think That's Bad, is filled with tales that blend fact and fiction, like the one about the real-life creator of Godzilla. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And as an 89.7 NPR News listener, nobody knows more about our programs and core values than you. We'd love to hear how we are doing, from our local programs to national shows, and how we've handled ourselves as a station during these challenging financial times. This is your chance to give us direct feedback on many of our programs and features. The survey is not very long and will be extremely valuable in helping serve you and other 89.7 listeners down the road. To participate in our survey, visit WOSU.org. And thank you in advance for your time and support of 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Symphony. The 2011 Picnic with the Pops series continues with the music of Michael Jackson this Saturday, June 25th, on the lawn of Chemical Abstract Service. Tickets and details at picnicwiththepops.com.
73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms today, likely this afternoon, a high of 81. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The Ohio General Assembly has passed and the governor is expected to sign a new law that will allow concealed carry permit holders to carry guns into bars, restaurants, and some stadiums serving alcohol. We wondered, what's the new etiquette? How does this work? We invited two of the interested parties, a spokesperson for Ohioans for Concealed Carry, Jeff Garvis. And Jeff, you're the president and founder of Ohioans for Concealed Carry. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Robert Himes, he's president of the Central Ohio Restaurant Association. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Well, hello there. Thank you.
When I'm trying to figure out how this law would work, I feel like it's trying to prove a negative. Jeff, what are the expectations from your point of view of how this would work? How, if it's a concealed weapon, that means we can't see it, and lots of people don't drink when they go to bars now. So what? How do you know? How's this supposed to work?
Well, I think from a restaurant perspective, nothing's going to change, and the vast majority of Ohio is not going to see any difference because from, you know, since 2004, anyone who's had a license to carry has been potentially carrying regularly in restaurants like Bob Evans or Cracker Barrel or any of these non-liquor serving establishments. The whole purpose of the bill was to address the restaurants that have a liquor license.
And will restaurants be able to put up a sign saying that guns are banned?
Absolutely. Every private property owner in the state of Ohio has had that right to do so since the law went into effect in 2004. And nothing that was written into this new legislation would prohibit them from doing that.
Well, then, so what does change? What's the point?
It allows people who go about their day and happen to carry a firearm to not have to leave it in their vehicle if they go into a restaurant that serves alcohol. Despite the fact that a lot of businesses can post those signs, the vast majority of major chains don't. So if you look at, like, for example, Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart, they actually have a nationwide policy that local management is not to post signs like that. And they experience no problems in those type of establishments. And I've seen the same for, you know, myself since 2004 in Ohio with chain restaurants like Cracker Barrel and Bob Evans.
Bob Himes of the Central Ohio Restaurant Association, do you agree that nothing really is going to change on, you know, on the surface?
No, we don't agree with that. He's named two of the chains which don't sell alcohol, but in fact, most restaurants do serve alcohol. And we're just of the opinion that alcohol and guns don't mix. And when we did a survey of all of our restaurants, we did it Friday, and only two of those restaurants thought this was a good idea, or two of those members thought it was a good idea. One didn't have an opinion, and all of the others, I've said, no, it was not a good idea. In fact, I've never had a survey that was so one-sided before.
What are your expectations of the responsibility of restaurants and bar managers/owners? What's their role in this? What would change? Would they have to check?
Well, we don't want to check, and as far as I know, I don't think we would be allowed to physically search anybody. We can ask them if they have a gun or not, but we're afraid that they'll come in with a gun. They may not intend to drink, but they'll get into a situation where they either do drink or they're with other folks that are drinking. And if we would serve alcohol to someone who had a gun, not knowing that they had a gun, then where's the liability if something happens and somebody gets shot and then we're accused of serving drinks to somebody with a gun and we have no way of knowing whether they had a gun or not?
Jeff Garvis of Ohioans for Concealed Carry, what do you think is going to happen in those cases? I mean, it's very rare. I mean, usually when there's a shooting, it's usually, I know, with a gun that they're not supposed to have in the first place. But if it happens, I mean, where is the liability? Where do you anticipate it falling?
Well, since the law was enacted in 2004, there's been exclusions in there for liability with respect to employers. So I believe that what you'll find is that there is no liability on behalf of a private property owner to inspect someone. There's no criminal penalties or charges for failure to, determine if someone is in possession of a firearm if you serve them. I would think that that liability concern would exist today. I mean, what if someone was to break the law and walk into a bar with a firearm and be served a drink?
Mm-hmm.
This law doesn't create new liability. What it does is it, if you think about it on the surface, it basically says the right to possess a firearm in an establishment is based on the actions of the individual. Are they consuming alcohol or not? And that's a more logical basis to ban possession of a firearm, because Bob and I would agree guns and alcohol don't mix, but I think it's guns and alcohol consumption that don't mix.
But if somebody's violating the law, if they're consuming alcohol and they're a permit holder and they have a weapon, they've concealed a weapon, who busts them? Are you
they
just
would
waiting?
Obviously they would have to do something that would get them caught. That's the way with most laws. How do you know that someone driving down the road is intoxicated? Because they get pulled over and they get a breathalyzer test. But I'm sure we would come to the same conclusion that a number of people probably do it all day.
You know,
does that mean that it's right? No.
The law has another part of it. It provides for the expungement of criminal records for previous convictions of improper storage of firearms in a motor vehicle. Isn't that previous behavior? Why would that be put in a law like this, given somebody's previous behavior? Wouldn't that be a signal?
Actually, the logic behind that, and you do make a good point, but the logic behind that is that when the law was passed, there was this fear that possession of a firearm in a vehicle would put officers at risk. It was a misguided fear. And what came of that was a very complex set of rules on how you needed to possess a firearm. And the end result was that people were getting charged with a crime for insignificant actions, failure to have it in a holster or not in a locked container. It was nothing of a violent nature. It was, you didn't store it exactly to the letter of the law, therefore you got hit with a crime. Now we've changed the law to say, all those restrictions we put into place a long time ago were a knee-jerk reaction. If you got convicted of them, we need to forgive them because they were a mistake in the first place.
Now, Bob Himes at the Central Ohio Restaurant Association, is it your understanding that a restaurant or a bar could just put up a sign and say they don't want them in there, and that's that?
You know, we understand that you're able to do that. We do not want to be policemen to check the fact that somebody has a gun or not after we put it up. We also are not looking to, antagonize our customers, which, like you said, Home Depot is, and these chains have decided they don't want to get into it with those customers and debate whether guns are a good thing or a bad thing. They just, there's alcohol here, which we think is a real problem, and it's against the law to drink and drive, but people do it all the time. And then there's the liability issue that, though I know what his opinion is, which may or may not be true, it hasn't been tested in court,
right.
And we're still afraid that that's going to be a problem.
Is it still an issue, Bob, that if restaurants or bars serve somebody until they're drunk, is there a liability issue for restaurants and bars if that person then goes out and drives drunk and causes damage?
Yes, there is.
And that's been in the courts. That's been
litigated through the courts and everything. And there have been times where people drank too much, went out and had a car wreck, killed somebody, and then the restaurant or the bartender was then sued. And we're just afraid that's going to happen with guns also if we serve somebody, and we have no way of knowing if they have a gun or not.
And Jeff Garvis, is there any language in the bill that would address that issue?
No, but I think the difference here is that the reason that establishment that serves alcohol is on the hook for giving too much alcohol to someone is because that becomes obvious. That's visible to them. The establishment has no knowledge that someone is carrying a firearm, and they can't be put in a position under this law the way it's been passed. There's nothing in here that requires them to come to that conclusion on their own. It's on the onus of the individual in possession of the firearm. And from a licensee standpoint, if you do get caught doing this, you lose your license for a year. It's a very serious charge. There's in certain cases, there's a felony involved, which is complete, revocation of numerous rights, including the right to own a firearm. So from a gun owner perspective, a law-abiding individual is going to go beyond their means to abide by the law.
A violation would be a fifth-degree felony, and the penalty is up to a year in prison and a $2,500 fine. 614-292-8513, that's a number to call if you have a question or a comment for either of our guests. Jeff Garvis, he's the president and founder of Ohioans for Concealed Carry, and also Bob Himes, he's president of the Central Ohio Restaurant Association. And Andrew, you're on the east side of Columbus, and we welcome you to the show.
Thanks. I just have three quick things. Number one, the gentleman keeps saying that, you know, it's on the onus of the individual. Individuals just are not very responsible, especially where alcohol and guns come into play. Secondly, I will not be going to any establishment that serves alcohol if there's going to be guns in there or even the thought of it. Then also, this just seems like a backwards law to me. So when Ohio talks about the brain drain and where young people who are college educated are going and why they're going, this is one of those laws that speaks to me that, gee, I think I might want to live somewhere else. Those are my thoughts, and I'll just listen offline. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Jeff Garvis of Ohioans for Concealed Carry, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I think to answer the brain drain issue, I would argue that the way we went about this in Ohio is substantially different than many other states. And the vast majority of the country allows this behavior. In fact, today with an Ohio license, I think there's about 18 states that recognize the Ohio license, and in 17 of those, you can go into an establishment today as an Ohioan visiting that state and go into a liquor-serving establishment. Now, the reason I say Ohio took a more aggressive approach is because we prohibit you from drinking. Our neighboring states like Michigan and Indiana and Pennsylvania allow you to drink to 0.02. So Ohio actually took a more aggressive and conservative approach to this and prohibited drinking. And the idea to say that people are irresponsible, then I would think that we'd have evidence from across the country and all the states that already have allowed this for over a decade that it's an issue, and it's not. And really the focus, again, is not on going into bars. It's on being able to go into a restaurant so you don't irresponsibly leave your firearm in your car to be stolen.
Bob Himes, would you like to respond?
Well, the irresponsibility, I think, is proven by the drinking and driving thing. I mean, people are irresponsible and drink and drive all the time, and when they're quite often been picked up, they'll swear up and down they're not drunk or shouldn't have had a problem, but they do.
You know, Bob, you feel like you're between a rock and a hard place, because on one hand, you said that you don't want to antagonize customers by putting up a sign. I mean, that's going to be a problem for some people. But on the other hand, you have folks like our caller just now who said they won't go into a restaurant or bar that doesn't have the sign up.
Absolutely, and that's our problem. We're trying to service our customers and respect all of their rights, and something like this really puts us in the middle of a place we don't want to be.
Robert in Columbus, you favor the new law that the governor's probably going to sign?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I feel that now the bar owners are not checking people prior to a law being in place, and you end up with shootings outside bars all the time. So, you know, people are illegally carrying guns into bars. And those people that are following the law and don't carry them in are therefore victims, because they're being shot by people that should not have guns or that have been drinking and carrying guns illegally.
Well, you're saying if they were shot. I mean, are there very many cases of people?
There's a famous case where there's a restaurant in Arizona where people were legally in the bar without weapons, or in the restaurant without weapons, mm-hmm. eating their meals, and someone that was mentally ill that should not have had a gun came in and killed like 8 people. And if someone had been there with their own weapon, they could have stopped that idiot. But no one was there, so therefore, they by following the laws, are setting down.
Bob Himes, do you want to respond to that? Thanks a lot for the call, Robert.
No, I'm really not here to get in a debate with these folks. We feel that it's, like you said, putting us between a rock and a hard spot, and guns and alcohol don't mix, and it's just that was one example possibly, but I would have hated to have been in there with a gun or had somebody else in there with a gun. And how about all the other people that are in there that can be shot accidentally by you started getting a gun battle in a place? It just seems like a bad idea to me.
So what are people talking about in the Restaurant Association? What are they trying to put together, some guidelines? What's the next step?
Well, if this is signed, we will obviously put together a statement to our members with some suggestions, but our members are all independent business people making up their own mind, and they all have to decide what they want to do.
Jeff Garvis, what's next as far as what are your expectations as far as how this law will work? Is it, like you said earlier, we won't even know it?
I really believe that. If you look back at the way the law went into effect in 2004, there was a rash of people who decided to post signs. A lot of them just did it because they were advised to do it either by, you know, an attorney or some other advisory role. They've, for the most part, substantially signs have come down across the state of Ohio because businesses started to realize that the impact is insignificant. The purpose of this law was to say that if you go to a restaurant to have dinner and you aren't going to consume any alcohol, then you can go in there with your firearm so that you're not leaving it in your vehicle. Yes, you are armed in case you might need it there, but it's not, you know, the real reason was so you didn't have to leave it in your car to be stolen. Practically, people that go to bars for the most part, and when I say bar, I mean a bar that does nothing but serve alcohol.
Right.
They're going there to consume. And to comply with the law, they're not going to consume. When it comes to motor vehicles, you're allowed to consume up to 0.08 and then get in the vehicle. So this is really not an apples-to-apples comparison.
And you're saying that folks who go into the bar and they're not supposed to consume, but, gee, they're just going to have one, and then they leave the bar or somebody threatens them and or they perceive a threat and they pull the gun out and shoot them. You're saying that even though case law has shown that bars and restaurants are responsible when someone leaves a bar drunk, that won't be the case in these situations?
It shouldn't, because there's nothing in the law that puts a liability on a private property owner to disarm or to not serve an armed individual. And if you look at the law that exists today, prior to this bill that hasn't been signed yet, it's a misdemeanor to be under the influence and in possession of a gun, and that's alcohol or any other drug. So it's already illegal to be in possession of a firearm and under the influence. And we don't have people across the state of Ohio being arrested for that.
What if somebody, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
But what if somebody spots somebody in a bar with a concealed weapon? You know, it's concealed, but they can see it, or they think there's a weapon there and they see that they're drinking. Is that something they should tell the police? Should they tell the bar owner? What do you recommend people do in those cases? I just have
a few
seconds left.
No,
either one?
If you believe that there's someone consuming alcohol and they're in possession of a firearm and you feel that you want to tell the police, by all means, that should be done.
Okay.
I mean, that's breaking the law. I mean, if you think someone's breaking the law, obviously you should call the police.
Jeff Garvis, president of Ohioans for Concealed Carry, and Robert Himes, president of the Central Ohio Restaurant Association. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Ohio Craft Museum and Gift Shop, presenting glass, ceramics, jewelry, and more made in American studios. Located at 1665 West 5th Avenue. Information at ohiocraft.org.